Life University podcast. I'm Dr. Karen Wyatt, hospice physician and author, bringing you information and inspiration on preparing for the end of life by living fully today. This is episode 93, and I'm glad you're here to join me today. As I'm recording this podcast, I'm actually in Portland, Oregon, attending the 7th Annual Afterlife Awareness Conference, which is very exciting for me. I'm really happy to be here in beautiful Portland. So I'm recording from my hotel room here. I'm going to be presenting a workshop here at the conference on spiritual self-care for death care workers. And actually, the major focus of the workshop is going to be on managing grief and the repressed grief that we tend to have in the healthcare system when we care for lots and lots of patients who are experiencing traumatic events and also dying. But because we're overloaded and overwhelmed, we don't have time to process our own feelings that arise as we deal with the traumas that surround us. So we tend to repress our feelings, repress the grief that arises, and not really process it. So the workshop will be talking about some tools that we can use to help us process grief and trauma on an ongoing basis as we're working with our patients in the end-of-life field. And I'm really excited to present it. This will be the first time I've ever presented this workshop, and so it means a lot to me, and I'm very excited to be here in order to provide that education. If you tune in regularly to the podcast, you will know that I just completed an 8-part special series on suicide involving the suicide of my father and my own journey of healing that followed his death. And that series began with episode number 85 through 92. And so it just finished last week on Memorial Day, was the 8th episode. If you haven't heard any of the podcasts, that podcast series, I encourage you to go back and listen to it. I've received a lot of really positive feedback from people who've been helped a great deal, some people who have experienced suicide in their own lives and were very, very touched. And also mentioned that it helped them with their own healing and moving through some of the grief and guilt that they have been carrying with them for years and years. So you can go back and find episode 85 is the very first episode in the series. You can listen to them in order, and now they're all posted, so you can listen to all 8. Each one is only about 30 minutes long, 30 to 40 minutes, so you can get through the whole series in a rather short time. And today's episode is really a follow-up in some ways of that, of the suicide series. During the series, I played a few clips of an interview I did with Dr. Jeff Black, who is a psychiatrist and a shaman who works with veterans to help them deal with trauma and PTSD symptoms after they return from war. And so I posted a few clips of my interview with Dr. Black during the podcast series, and I was thinking that it might be great to play the entire interview for you. And it happens that this interview was from the 2016 Death and Afterlife Summit that I recorded last year. And Dr. Black was a speaker at this afterlife conference last year, where I am right now sitting as I'm recording this podcast. So I thought you might enjoy hearing our entire discussion about traumatic events and how we heal from them, and how Dr. Black has very successfully used shamanic practices to help veterans who are suffering the effects of trauma. So rather than focusing primarily on medications, Dr. Black has found these shamanic healing methods to be very, very effective. So I wanted to just share that entire interview with you because I found it fascinating and thought as a follow-up to the suicide podcast series, you might find that interesting as well. So we'll be getting into that interview shortly. Meanwhile, I wanted to thank my newest sponsor for this podcast, which is Rabbi Lori Dinnerstein-Kurz. And Lori is going to be a guest on the End of Life University speaker series at eoluniversity.com later this month in June. And I'll be interviewing her about Jewish practices around death and dying. But Lori has stepped up and volunteered to be a sponsor for the podcast, and I'm really grateful. All of the patrons who have donated money to help support the podcast have made a big difference for me in keeping this podcast on the air, and I'm really grateful to all of you. If you're interested in offering your support, you can go to my donation page at patreon.com/EOLU, and you can sign up to make a donation of $1 or $2 a month just to help support the podcast. And I really appreciate it. It helps me defray all the expenses incurred in recording episodes and interviews and setting all of this up online, the websites, email service providers, recording equipment, everything that that I have to purchase in order to do the podcast and the interview series. So once again, thank you so much to all of my sponsors. I really, really appreciate that. If you're interested in listening to the interview series at End of Life University, just go to eoluniversity.com and you can sign up there to be a subscriber. You'll get a total of 3 emails a month. One will be just a general kind of a newsletter type email at the beginning of each month explaining what's coming up that month that you can look forward to. And then you'll get an email on the day of each of the interviews telling you how to access the speaker if you'd like to listen. So I'm excited to share all of the great speakers we have coming up for the rest of this year of 2017. So you can go to eoluniversity.com and sign up if you'd like to receive those notifications. And finally, the show notes for this episode of the podcast are available at eolupodcast.com. And you'll be able to find links there to interesting websites and other references and sources that I mentioned during the podcast. If you follow at eolupodcast.com, you can also subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And if you're so inclined, it's really helpful if you leave a review for the podcast on iTunes. That just helps the podcast get noticed by other people who might be searching for content like this. So without further ado, we'll get on with the interview with Dr. Jeff Black. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I'll be back to join you after this interview ends.
Today I'm talking with Dr. Jeffrey Black, who has both a medical degree and a master's in divinity. And Jeff and I actually met at last year's Afterlife Conference, and ever since then I've been very excited to talk to him. So I'm really looking forward to this interview today. I'll tell you just a little bit more about Dr. Black. He is a psychiatrist who trained in energy medicine with native healers from South America. He is certified to teach Dying Consciously, The Greatest Journey, and is a part of the Living and Dying Consciously project. Prior to medical school, he attended seminary, which is where he got his master's in divinity. He uses his training to help those with traumatic experiences find a direction of peace and self-healing. So, Jeff, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here today.
Thank you, Karen. I'm excited about talking with you.
Yeah, I'm very excited, too. And I'll just warn our listeners, there might be a little telephone issue occasionally that we're going to try to work our way around, but to have patience with us and bear with us if anything seems to cut out or go wrong, we'll be piecing this together and trying to overcome our technological problems. So, Jeff, I was hoping that you'd start by telling a little bit more about your story, which I find fascinating. And as a medical doctor myself, I'm really curious about how you went from being a seminarian to a psychiatrist to a shaman. It sounds like an amazing journey to me, so I'd love to hear a little more about that.
Sure, Karen. I started off in college thinking I wanted to go to medical school, and about halfway through found that I was very interested in people's stories and how they live their life, but also very much interested in the spirituality of people's stories and even of religion, and decided halfway through to not go to medical school and go to seminary. But while I was in seminary, was influenced by a great professor, Elizabeth Barnes, who really taught me a lot about living in the midst of the village, as she put it, and doing things that involve direct contact. And I was thinking then about teaching potentially, and so I went through a series of life events and made the decision to go to medical school. And while I was in med school, thought about a bunch of different options. But when I did psychiatry, that whole idea of going back to people's stories really stuck with me. And so I started doing psychiatry, trained in child and adolescent and family psychiatry as well as adult psychiatry, and then started practicing in 97. About 5 years into practice, really just found myself stuck in this mindset of what was I really doing for people. It seemed like I was trying to manipulate the body system, manipulate thought patterns through different types of therapies or through medications, and it just didn't seem to really be clicking with me. And so I had some experiences through the Chopra Center in California through Deepak Chopra, and learning about meditation and awareness and mindfulness even then, and did some work with that and learned about integrative medicine at that point, integrating Eastern and Western traditions, and started sort of a lifelong interest or almost like a hobby sort of feeling to it, but still felt like I was missing something. I had a really good friend of mine who went through an experience with Native American healers and shamanic teachings, and I started the process of working with the Four Winds Society learned a lot about shamanism, and had direct experiences, shamanic experiences, both through the courses I took through them as well as travels to Peru, and really saw a huge need and a huge hole I felt in using energy medicine within a Western modeled institution. And so had an opportunity to use mostly for people who'd experienced trauma, but also were dealing with significant issues, spiritual, mental and emotional issues in their life, and use some of the shamanic practices to help them transform some of that energy, and really felt like this was what I'd been meaning to do or needing to do. I also took it in Ayurveda, medicine through the California College of Ayurveda this past year, and that's really something. And so that's been a wonderful addition to what I can do.
I was just going to say, now I see why you and I click a little bit, because I think we come from a really similar mindset in that I had some longings to go to seminary too when I was in college, trying to decide between seminary and medicine. And I ended up going into family practice, but then doing a fellowship in psychiatry, because I was always looking for something more. Like, there has to be something
right.
Some more pieces I can add to this education I have. It never felt complete to me. I'm wondering if you in medical practice, like the feeling I had with when I've practiced within traditional Western medicine is always that I had to hide what I'm doing. I have to hide how I see things and what I'm doing. Have you experienced that at all?
I have. I think I'm learning how to be in the midst of it all, and from an energetic standpoint, I think learning how to use certain language. I don't use the word shaman. I don't use the word energy medicine, although that's more accepted these days by certain groups. But I try to use language that actually helps people be a little bit more comfortable with it. And so like when I do some shamanic work with people who have trauma, then I usually talk about it being a guided meditation with props. I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm just using language that people tend to understand and feel there's still some integrity with doing that, or still is integrity with doing that. But I've had that feeling that you have to be kind of cautious, but I think over the past 3 or 4 years, I've really realized that if you do things that are helpful to people, I don't need to broadcast it everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing the work that helps people, and you don't have to convince people that the techniques you're using, you don't have to convince people to accept the techniques. You just do the work, and that's
right.
What makes
you do the work. And yeah. And I think if you do the work and people have an opportunity to experience it, then what you call it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking we may have some listeners who aren't familiar with shamanism, and I was wondering if you could just, I know it's hard to sum that up in a nutshell, but if you could just give us some of a few basics about shamanism and energy medicine so that everyone's on the same page and understanding how you practice with those.
So the tradition, the stories that I heard in this tradition I was, came out of, it talks a lot about shamans, are really journeyers. They're map makers, meaning that they develop an intimate connection with a deeper consciousness through journeying and the belief and use of both energy from the world around us, as well as the energies from ancestors and those who've come before us. Their function outside of time, in that we usually think of various things, life basically as birth, life, and birth and death, and everything in between as being very linear. And so this sort of function outside of time and the idea of being able to experience, the connection and energy with someone and being able to help them shift that energy is one of the things that interested me, and especially about working with people with trauma. So what all that means is the two biggest tools that I was taught that I use are the idea of an illumination. Illumination is actually having someone move energy. The idea that in a lot of different traditions, especially everything from Vedic traditions on, have the idea of energy centers, or in some traditions they call them chakras, where we have energy, and energy may get stuck. And so this comes out of the idea that we are made up of an energy body, an ethereal or soul piece type body, a mental and emotional body, and a physical body. And that most of what I was taught in allopathic medicine and Western medicine was to be, especially with psychiatry, is to deal with the physical, mental, and emotional body and not speak to the deeper parts of the soul, or not religious soul, but the deeper parts of ourself, as well as the energetic body. And so shamans work at the energetic level and sometimes at the soul piece to help people transform energy or shift energy in a different way, let go of energy, extract energy, They also do a very, I was taught, and I do this quite a bit, with people, especially with trauma, is, it's an intriguing process called a soul retrieval, which is the belief that when we have trauma, and this has been sort of, Edward Tick, has written a great book called War in the Soul, and a lot with, veterans that talk about when a trauma occurs that part of them split off. And sort of psychobabble terms, we talk about dissociation, that you help return that soul piece back to the person, to help them, start the process of moving towards wholeness. And in that movement towards wholeness, a lot of healing can occur that takes place almost, you know, one or two sessions with retrieval, can do, as much as a multitude of talk therapy sessions. And that's been played out in my experience time and time again. I'm always kind of chuckle and pleasantly surprised that it, sometimes I say to myself, wow, this stuff really does work. And, I've been doing it for a while.
So could you describe for us what a soul retrieval session might look like? Like what happens during a session like that?
Sure. There are different ways that it's taught. I know Sandra Ingerman teaches the soul retrieval process in a different way, but the idea is that the soul retrieval process starts off with a process of moving energy, and then the shaman the person acting as the shaman is basically connected. The person's they open a sacred space, and then the person is starts moving energy that doesn't belong to them anymore. Sort of like the idea of letting go of stories that no longer work, and the tradition is that shaman will then journey to find the soul piece. And there's a specific journey that you go on each time, and you have this opportunity to find different representations of the original, what people would call the original wounding, and then the idea of the soul piece that was left behind, what kind of contracts people make with themselves, what kind of stories, deep consciousness type stories do people hold on to? And you bring that piece back, and in the tradition, you blow that into one of the energy centers, usually into the heart. And then you have an opportunity to have the person debrief and talk through the images that you saw. A lot of the images that I see sometimes don't make much sense to me, that make a lot of sense to the person, give them an opportunity to step into a new way of thinking about things. So they step into a role, side of what they used to call psychodramas, and that process of allows them to have a different experience with what they're dealing with. But it also sort of takes the trauma that they may have experienced out of the present moment and shifts it out of a linear way of looking at the trauma, that this is something I have to hold on to the rest of my life, to allowing them to shift that energy into something more open and in a sense more liberating, I think, by doing the soul retrieval. I'm not telling you everything just because it's kind of a hard process to go through, but it's really about helping somebody, journeying for someone on behalf of someone to help them reconnect with the parts of themselves that that they may have separated from themselves when they had the trauma or a past difficult experience, or in some people's beliefs, even from a past life kind of idea.
Wow, it sounds so powerful.
So basically, soul retrieval, what really clicked with me when I had the experience of having that done for me is also, as well as participating in it as a receiver of the soul retrieval, as well as doing soul retrievals, was that it actually it illustrates that inherent ability for people to heal from within, that we have that, that I feel like part of what I do now is not try to impose something upon someone or give them something, you know, techniques or, although those can be helpful and ways to learn about mindfulness and awareness, that can all be helpful, but it's more about helping them tap into what they already have inside of them, and helping them work with that as a means to bring about healing. Because part of a lot of the trauma work that's being done, even now, has a lot to do with exposing people to the trauma over and over and over again, which may find, they may find some relief. I think, some people would say they find permanent relief, but I think they find relief more because they become very numb to it, desensitized to it. And it may help initially, sort of like a medication may help initially decrease anxiety, but you're not really treating the source of the anxiety. And so what a soul retrieval does is allow that person to, those parts that have been separated, and the idea that when you have this piece of yourself, piece of your soul separated from you, it creates this deep consciousness imbalance that needs to be brought back into balance. And these are my conceptions of this. You talk to other great shamanic teachers, they may talk to other teachers who are great and that I've studied under, who are just wonderful people. They may very much say it in a different way, but my understanding and what really clicked for me is here's an opportunity for someone to really start that process of healing from deep within, that deep energetic consciousness, instead of it being sort of an outside fix that may solve the problem temporarily, and maybe even solve the problem in terms of them being emotionally very attached to the story for a long time. But I don't see it in terms of it being a process of deep healing. And mainly I say that mainly out of experience, not out of research. The experience I've had, personal experience in terms of people I work with now, is I'm seeing people who have gone through prolonged exposure therapies and some other types of therapies, and they're ending up coming back because other parts of their life, how they were responding to the trauma, is starting to leak back into how they're responding to their families and colleagues and life in general. So it's that deep healing, I think, that soul retrieval can really really access.
I really like what you're saying there about the idea of empowering the person to find their own healing from within, because that's been one of the issues I've had with Western medicine, even as a practitioner of Western medicine, is that much of what we do in medicine disempowers people, and it actually it disconnects them from their own sense that they're able to heal themselves. We make people reliant on medications that they have to take external to themselves or treatments that they have to receive, and medications and treatments that might actually make them feel terrible in order to try to treat an illness. And so it has never made sense to me, that approach to trying to help someone heal. So I can see tremendous value as you're talking about, and that you really are achieving healing and transformations for patients by helping them recognize that they have this capacity within them that they can use at any time.
Yeah. And I think what you said about the word disconnect, that we disconnect. We are a frenetic culture anyway, and we're very disconnected from our bodies, disconnected from the deeper parts of ourselves. You know, I think that's where the powerfulness of mindfulness seems to be becoming. It's been a wonderful and grand thing for thousands of years, but it seems to be coming into vogue now in some of the mainstream journals. Sometimes they talk about mindfulness and blood pressure, but it's more like a technique again. And although there's some great looking at stress reduction and mindfulness, but this disconnection from our bodies and disconnection from the deeper parts of ourselves are what keep us just sort of stuck, sort of walking around half asleep, in other words.
That's so true. And I'm really finding myself fascinated by, I know that you use these techniques with veterans a lot, and my own father, and I might have mentioned this to you, was a veteran who ultimately ended up committing suicide.
Yeah.
And I believe it had a lot to do with the trauma he experienced during World War II that he could never talk about, never tell anyone about, and it was so buried deep within him, but you could just feel it when you were around him, that there was something that was pulling him away, that was taking him away from being right. present with us.
And it's, and it, that's really that unfinished business people have, the unfinished business people, especially people in terms of wartime trauma, with the veterans I work with, and even active duty people that I've worked with, that there's an unfinished business about the whole thing that tends to drive them, whether it be a feeling of guilt that they should have been the one to die instead of their friend, or they should have helped, or they could have done something. Even if it doesn't make any logical sense, there's this sense of unfinished business that keeps driving that story. And I think other people have worded it, like Edward Tick has talked about in his book, I mentioned earlier, War in the Soul, and then Warrior's Return, talks a lot about that soul piece that leaves, that disconnects from a person, and they don't feel whole. And it's as if some people have given me feedback saying that it's as if that piece came back and they finally felt they can start the process of moving forward, and however that will look. And so it's not a matter of all of a sudden everything's right with the world, but it does have this sense in which after they've had some of these different experiences, the world feels like they can at least start working within it and moving forward and living their life in a different way, and not constantly searching for that piece of them that's no longer, that they feel isn't a part of them anymore, that separated during the trauma or had to separate when they had to do the things that they did. And I think
that happens
with death and loss too. I think people separate or they have unfinished business, and they have a tendency to hold on to that unfinished business as a means to either hold on to the person that's died or hold on to their own sense of trying to hold on to something that would try to make sense out of the life and death of the person. So,
And that's interesting, because I think our society really reinforces keeping the business unfinished around death and dying, because we really don't have many rituals or many processes
right.
for helping people just experience their grief and be there with it. And over and over, I'll hear someone grieving who said, well, I went back to work and everyone around me behaved as if nothing had happened
right.
and no one would talk to me about it. No one would acknowledge that I've experienced a loss, and I need some time and space for that to hold on to that. People don't acknowledge it in our society.
And I think I know certain physicians, even people I talked to about medical students, when I taught medical students for a while, they talked a lot about end of life issues, that they didn't feel like they had the time to teach them much about end of life issues, because they really needed to talk to them about learning how to save life. And that always bugged me, and I was thinking of it recently, that part of what they're really saying is that we are still involved in this very reductionistic, mechanical model of medicine that thinks that saving life is intervention, is drugs, it's surgeries, it's doing all these things to try to just save the actual physical process of life and not look at the entirety of the person and actually help them through the healing process, which may not involve curing their disease, but may involve them being able to live their life in such a way that they can let go at the end with a sense of peace and completion. I think we focus so much on the idea that we're trying to save lives by, and what I've already said in terms of teaching them how to be mechanistic sometimes. I know there are pockets of people that learn differently and people who are very interested in doing it differently, but that's kind of been my feedback from others who do teach med students or who are involved in residency programs, that they think that they need to focus on doctors have to be about saving lives, and that's true to some extent, but sometimes saving a life is sometimes letting it go, you know. But I think that's hard for physicians to really swallow.
And I understand some of the difficulty there is that the body of knowledge these days for medical students and residents to learn is so vast and expansive.
Yes.
It's as if, what should we leave out in order to make more room for end-of-life issues? And I can see the challenge in it. But another thought that occurred to me is, I myself feel like I was traumatized as a medical student through some of the deaths that I witnessed in the hospital as part of my training. You know, a 16-year-old girl, I was part of a resuscitation effort. She'd been in an auto accident, and you know, it went on for 3 or 4 hours in the ER that we tried to bring her back and ultimately failed. And after she died, everyone else just returned to their jobs, to their work. Not one person talked about it. And I remember feeling that was one of the first deaths I had ever witnessed as a student. And I just remembered feeling so traumatized, and then doubly traumatized, because not one person would talk to me or would help me process all these emotions that I had inside about what had just occurred.
And I think that may be the key to education, is maybe it's not about giving reams of material for the people to learn. Maybe it's teaching the teachers to basically stop and really acknowledge what's going on, and really shifting the idea of maybe you have to teach residents, not medical students, how to deal with death and dying. And you know, that would have been an unbelievable opportunity, one that you remember now, just the trauma of it all. That would have been an unbelievable opportunity for a physician or a mentor or even a nurse or nurse practitioner or somebody to say, to stop and acknowledge this person and what happened, and then giving opportunity for people to feel what they feel. And I know the excuse tends to be, well, we've got other things to do, we've got other people to save, but then this life, this person, becomes something other than that life and that person. They just become, here's somebody that we failed bringing back, and now it's time to move on.
And if all of the teachers of medicine themselves have been traumatized in their own training,
exactly,
and then so they've lost pieces of their soul that they
exactly
can't bring to that moment. They can't be present for it because they've already dissociated themselves from that part of themselves, that they can't feel their own emotions or engage
exactly
in what's happening and be involved. And so it makes sense. There's no one there who can be present to actually teach. And as you said, those moments would be prime teaching moments, way better than giving a lecture and a PowerPoint presentation
exactly
about the end of life. But to be there while it's happening, to be there when a patient is, you know, the 95-year-old is being coded in the ER, that no one wants to run the code, but because there's no advanced directive, it has to be
right
done. But to be there and process it and talk it through and teach in that moment, would be phenomenal.
And I think it'd take one or two of those experiences, and that would shift for each person, and that would really shift the energy, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's something I'd love to be, that teacher. I'd love to be the death teacher who got to wander around the halls of the hospital, and I'll come and sit with you and be there while you're processing your emotions about having a patient die that you were trying to save.
And it would be, and I'm not sure if it's, I know some places have you know, they have teams, but it seems like it's always more the hospice team or the chaplain or somebody else, and really having residents be able to have an experience of death and dying and have that experience of being there and being present and being able to talk through it would be phenomenal. And so maybe that opportunity will open up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really fascinating. You'll be doing soul retrievals in medical schools and residency programs. but I think you're right. I think
you probably couldn't call them that exactly, but
yeah.
The actual language itself, there are some people who are writing, instead of calling it post-traumatic stress disorder, calling it post-traumatic soul loss. And the idea of soul not being a religious idea of soul, but just that deeper part of ourself, you know.
Yeah. Very interesting. Wow, I had no idea our conversation would go in this direction,
yeah.
But I'm really liking this. And I think you're right. I think things could shift fairly quickly in medicine and how we approach death and dying if we handled these experiences better in the moment.
Right, right.
Well, I was wondering, Jeff, if you could suggest, if there's someone listening in who has experienced trauma themselves and kind of has a recognition like that's where I am. I've lost a piece of my soul. Are there some tips that you have or things that people could do on their own who maybe don't have access to someone like you who could help them? Or do you have any suggestions for people?
Yes, I think first and foremost, a person has to have a sense of compassion towards themselves. I think many people who've experienced trauma, the trauma continues to get in the way of the present moment of their life right now because they're trying to make it all make sense. And sometimes it doesn't make sense. I know some of the younger kids I worked with, most of the time they're looking for a way to make it make sense, and they end up blaming themselves. So having a lot of compassion, I think, towards yourself, and then knowing that idea that we heal from within, and it may be, you know, I think it's important sometimes if people feel like they're stuck and they've got some unfinished business that they talk to somebody, but someone who would recognize that it's not that external story itself that may need healing. It's what that story did, either the event that happened or the trauma that happened or the loss that happened, what it sort of did to unlodge something within you or separate, cause you to separate. And I think there are a lot of therapies that are out there. I like the one thing I like people to do is to look at the idea of unfinished business. And Jack Kornfield has written a book called Wise Heart. It's a Buddhist psychology text, but it's he talks about the acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N. And I think it sort of acknowledged some of the healing process, and that's recognize what's happened, the trauma, or even maybe not necessarily the trauma itself, but what does it bring up for me? And almost using journaling where you get into a quiet place and you ask yourself the question, you know, what is this about? How does this affect me? What do I feel in my body? Where do I feel it in my body? Is there, when I look at that feeling, when I put my hands there, what is that? What's the quality of the feeling? Just recognizing that first and foremost. And then A is acknowledge or accept. Acceptance, not like giving up acceptance, but acceptance in that, okay, it's here. This is a part. I don't need to run from this anymore. I don't need to get away from it anymore or try to numb myself out or do something to avoid what I need to feel. And I think that's where recognizing the body and the quality of the sensation in the physical body can come into play. And then the I is investigate, and that's really asking questions for yourself. Is there a pattern here? How is this affecting me? How do I feel like it has changed how I view the world? How would I want things to be? And sometimes those investigative questions don't have any immediate answers, but they start the process within, I think, universal consciousness of really bringing up those things that need to heal, start the shifting process, just even asking the question. And the last one is more of a, I call it a psychobabble term, and that is non-attachment. But the idea is not attaching yourself to the story itself, but really looking at how this story really has been a part of my life, and what do I need to do. And then I think one of the most important things that you can do, it's a very shamanic tradition, is take it to a ritual. And one of the simplest ones is take it to fire. If you have the ability to build a small fire, even a candle, or but even having an opportunity, very moving. I've seen some very moving experiences occur for people when they sit with a fire and they have some smaller sticks, and when the fire, as they say, when the fire gets friendly and it's not raging, then having an opportunity to blow those things into the stick with the understanding that as they blow, they're putting energy into this solid mass of energy that will then go into the fire and release all that energy. And just the transformative view of idea of fire and that ritual and that opportunity to blow that trauma, blow that memory, blow that thankfulness, that I'm sorry, the I love you, the please forgive me, blowing all those things into that stick and then throwing it into the fire can be very cleansing for people. And having that experience, I've seen some people who've had wartime trauma just have very moving experiences for them, where they feel a sense of cleansing and a sense of transformation by doing that. But really, the idea of rain and working through what's unfinished, and then the idea, most importantly, then, is taking all that with non-attachment to a ritual, whether it be fire or water, can be and it doesn't have to be something that everybody does. It can be something that makes sense to you, using fire, using water, and the idea the within the ritual itself is having a means to acknowledge. You know, recognizing knowledge, accept, and then that letting go, that non-attachment, that putting it in the fire or putting it in the water, can be very, very powerful, I think, for people. And really call on that inside, that treatment, well, that internal, deeper consciousness that really holds our creativity, holds our light, holds our ability to heal, holds our capacity to love, and allowing that to burn brighter and brighter.
Wow, I really like that. I can see how helpful that could be. And I like the idea of going within to search for a way to heal the wounding that's there, rather than going externally to look for a source of blame, like externally to blame another person or an event or a situation for the wounding that you have, to simply accept that this is what I have, so I'm going to heal it within myself, and to let go of the blaming, which it seems moves us in the opposite, moves us away from healing if we're putting our energy into blaming something outside of us.
Yes, very much so. It's very powerful, I think.
Yes, definitely, definitely. So that's just a wonderful technique. I like that mnemonic of rain, and then the idea of a ritual of some sort, which I think really kind of ties down the process you've been working through, and
yes,
really embodies it, like really makes it real by creating a ritual to go through.
Right.
That's very beautiful. I thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, sure. Yes. I've used this for myself as well, so that's, it's not something I just talk about. So, and have been able to be witness to people using this as well. And it's, to me, it's a very moving thing to be able to just hold space for someone while they, and that's in my experiences with the four winds, one of the beautiful things about taking things to the fire and with other people who are there is that the tradition is that someone is, someone stands behind you with their arms outstretched, literally saying to you, I've got your back. So, and if you're doing this on your own, the idea, of welcoming those who've gone before you, your ancestors, those people that you knew, people you don't know, but just having a visualization of this energy being behind you, having your back while you do this, feeling wholly protected and able to really give yourself to the process. And that is another, I think, whether you do it individually and or whether you do it with another person can be very powerful. So,
Well, that's a wonderful tool for anyone listening that you could definitely use as you're working through your own issues and your own wounding and traumas from life.
And just sometimes people who work with people who have difficulties with trauma and loss, just the experiences, sort of like your experience of being a medical student with that 16-year-old, there are plenty of opportunities for them to deal with their own sense of response to others' experiences and hopefully giving them an opportunity to find a sense of transformation and compassion for themselves as well. So it's for, you know, any age, someone who, can really talk through things, probably not for little kids, but even older adolescents all the way to people who are a good bit older. And also I think, allowing, it would be the kind of thing where people can sit in chairs or sit on the floor. I'm not exactly sure how large the group shouldn't be too large, and it's going to be some voluntary sharing. It's not going to be something where I don't want somebody to worry that they have to come in and talk about their past. That's not the goal of this at all. So.
I was just thinking that a large number of people in our audience listening to us today are practitioners who work
right.
with people at the end of life, and these would be great tools to have because unfinished business is such an important concern for our patients as they're
right.
as they're close to dying, and to have the more tools we have available and the deeper understanding we have of how to help people in their process of healing, I think that could be so valuable to really help someone through something who's getting ready to die, but, you know, needs a little more processing before they can be at peace.
Yeah, and there's there's a wonderful video, too, out there called Go in Peace, which is specifically about veterans who had who are at the end of life. But that's specifically for people who've had loss. Unfinished business, to me, tends to be exactly like what you said, tends to be what causes them to hold on to something that really keeps them from being able to move on.
So I'm so happy, Jeff, that we finally got a chance to talk. It's been really
yes.
fun to hear about the work that you're doing. I'm so impressed, and I'm thrilled to. It's not very often that I find a physician colleague that I can even talk to about the soul and energy and shamanism, and that's been really fun for me.
It's been fun for me too. I can tell you where I am now that there's not a huge list of people I can talk to about this either.
Well, Yeah, I'm looking forward to, I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk again at the next Afterlife Conference, and I'm really looking forward to that again. I want to thank you, Jeff, for the work you're doing, for being a pioneer, and for the courage that you have in just going forward with this work, doing the right thing, and really helping people with their healing.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. And thank you for hosting this and putting it all together.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure. I get the privilege of talking to people like you and so much enjoyment out of these interviews.
Well, that's it. My interview with Dr. Jeff Black, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Again, this was from the Death and Afterlife Summit back in 2016. But I wanted to share that with you, the complete interview, in case you had heard some of the clips of Dr. Black speaking during the 8-part podcast series on suicide that just finished last week at the very end of May. So thanks again to everyone for tuning in today to the podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, be sure and go to iTunes and look up End of Life University podcast with Dr. Karen Wyatt and leave a review. That helps the podcast to be seen by more people who will be able to find it more easily if they're searching for content like this. And remember, you can go to eoluniversity.com if you'd like to sign up for the online interview series. And you can listen to 2 interviews a month that I'll be broadcasting and posting there. Thanks again for joining me in this podcast. It's really fun. It's my great pleasure to present this information for you and keep it coming. I will be here every week on a Monday. You can expect a new podcast episode. So until next week, take care. Goodbye.